Osiris.
Hey everyone, it's Cam Hurt, host of the Best Show Ever podcast, and we have got a second season coming out very soon that I am very excited about. We've got some very cool special guests, including musical acts that we all love, like Karina Reichman, Daniel Donato, Jake Brownstein from Eggy, Rick and Peter from Goose, and many more. Tune in for new episodes dropping on Osiris Media March 5th on the Best Show Ever podcast.
My name is Leo Nocentelli. I'm a guitarist and founding member of a group that goes by the name of The Meters. I'm in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Now, for folks who don't know who The Meters are, and everyone should know who The Meters are, many people have heard stuff like Sissy Strut sampled in hip-hop songs for generations. But, you know, it's almost like the house band of New Orleans. I mean, I know that's kind of a slogan, but in a way, The Meters symbolize, I think, this confluence of New Orleans sound. You have the funk, you have the brass, but it's also rock and roll, soul, and what you brought out of this band into your solo record, Another Side, is the American roots music, the backbone,
Well, I think that when these four guys got Art, Zig, George, and myself, when we finally got together to do some things, I think it was a magical thing, man, by the songs. I was the main writer for the song, and it was it manifested itself in the studio with those three guys. And I forgot the question.
I don't know if there was a question. Do I still have to do an intro, or can I just let that funk play out for the rest of the podcast? Well, I guess I'll do it anyway. My name is Zach Lupitin, your humble audio spirit guide. This is the show on the road. Thank you for listening. And as you just heard, we're going to be going on a journey with the amazing Leo Nocentelli, who many of you may not have heard of until this day. In fact, I've listened to The Meters my whole life. I never knew who was behind the groove. And that's my job, to dive a little deeper into how the greatest music of all time was really made. Now, Leo and I have never met in person, but I think somehow we're kindred spirits, because we love folk music and funk music and think they should get married and have a baby. And that's honestly what I'm trying to do with my band Dust Bowl Revival in creating a new music festival called the Paramount Ranch Sonic Boom. It's in LA, October 15th. We're bringing Rebirth Brass Band from New Orleans to play with us. It's going to be magical. Please buy a ticket, and we'll see you there. Okay, without further ado, here's Leo Nocentelli of The Meters. Do you remember the first time that you knew that you were going to be a professional musician, that you knew that this was going to be your life?
I think that's a normal thing, an automatic thing that happens. I knew it when I was like 8 years old.
It's pretty early.
But the fact of knowing it does not register in your brain then.
Right.
But, subliminally, I guess. You know it. You automatically know it, man. When I first picked up a $2.98 plastic toy four-string ukulele that my dad bought me in a Five and Dime store. And I guess another sign of knowing is the fact that when I picked it up, I automatically started picking out tunes, picking out songs that I've heard on the radio or heard from somewhere. So
right.
It's just an automatic thing, man, that I didn't know where it came from, but it just happened. You know, my dad was not a great guitarist, nowhere near the level I've become, and a banjo player, but he had enough information where it was something for me to grab onto and instill in my computer, in my brain, I like what I was hearing, and I would like to try to duplicate what he was doing. So, you know, I guess you do know at a very early age.
Well, do you think that when you grow up in New Orleans, especially, you know, I know you're, you know, from the 7th Ward neighborhood, is that something that's more in the blood than more most places, you know, that you see everyone around you doing second lines, doing the funeral marches, doing, you know, these family bands, the Indian, you know, sort of dress. It's part of the culture. Like, you almost don't have a choice for a lot of folks like you, maybe.
No, you don't. You don't. Unless you just don't like it at all. When you see it, you just try to stay away from it. But I say the majority of people that comes up in New Orleans, they don't really have a choice because they grow up with it. They, you know, they just grew up with it. In terms of 7th Ward, 13th Ward, I mean, New Orleans is built upon different wards, you know, as you go through the city. You know, you got the 3rd Ward, you got the 9th Ward, 8th Ward, 7th Ward, 13th Ward.
Right.
But I think even though it's segregated to different wards, everybody has the same feeling about one particular thing, because you grew up in the 7th Ward, don't this, you know, it's the same thing as if you were in the 13th Ward. The second line is all, you always, everybody feels the same thing in the whole city.
And were you backing up folks like Otis Redding by the time you were a teenager?
I would say, yeah. My first really serious encounter was in the studio. There's a guy by the name of Alan Toussaint that was a very prolific writer and producer in New Orleans. Heard about this little guy, you know, maybe about 14 years old, around the city, and he hired me to do a session, man, and it was the session wound up being a Lee Dorsey session by recording a song by the name of Yaya, and that came to be a very popular song in New Orleans and around the world, you know, and that was the most serious encounter I've had with trying to be a professional musician in the city, and just kept on growing. How I love you all. Sitting in la la waiting for my ya-ya. Sitting in la la waiting for my ya-ya. It may sound funny, but I don't believe she's coming out. This solo record that was maybe lost for 50 years, Another Side, which has been reissued and sort of really finished with this new appreciation from you and yeah. your collaborators, I think shows the roots and the folk base that is, you know, a spine that was never appreciated as holding up the meters, you know, that this is really American folk music at its core. Yeah. Well, I think... where this record came from didn't have anything to do with the meters. The story behind it, and it's really not it's not a reissue. This record has never been issued before. It never been out before. It just happened to be with a reissuing record label called Light and Attic.
Right.
But to get back to the story, I want to say is this. The Meters had done 3 albums, funk albums, right. all instrumental, for a record label by the name of Josie Records.
Right.
And that was all I knew. That was all we all knew in the Meters.
Right.
And consequently, the record company went defunct, Josie Records out of New York. So that left the Meters without a record company, without a record label or anything.
Okay.
So in terms of our producers and management, we didn't have anything to go to the studio for. So I found myself stagnant and said, well, what am I gonna do? So besides just playing the same stuff we were recording with the Meters. So I bought a couple of albums by James Taylor.
Yeah.
Which one of my favorite artists, man, and I started listening at the songs on this record, on both of his records, "What Size Slim" and "Sweet Baby Jane,"
right?
And I started noticing the chord progressions. It was chord progression that I've never used before.
Mm.
And the lyrics he was talking, he was telling stories,
right?
Whereas you know, the stuff I was writing for the Meters, it was instrumental. You didn't have to think of nothing. Babe, I love you. I hate your guts. But, you know, it wasn't none of that. You know, so I said, I like what this guy is saying. And so I started writing songs accordingly to what I was hearing, that acoustic sound of his records. And in my own way, and implementing my own feelings about what I want to say and how I want to play. So I went in the studio, man. I wrote 10 songs and went in the studio with that, and recorded 10 songs like that, all acoustic. I used some of the guys. Actually, I used some of the guys in the Meters to play it along with me.
Right.
Alan Toussaint played on it, the keyboardist, and a very accomplished drummer by the name of James Black, which was unbelievable player. This was in 1971.
Yeah.
It's a long time ago. So this particular record, the spiritual phenomenon about this thing is that it's really an unfinished product. It's really unfinished, man. But there was enough there when the record. There was enough there when the Meters finally got a record deal from Warner Brothers. We did about 5 albums with Warners. I literally stopped that project, the other side project. I stopped, man. I stopped producing. I stopped working on it. And the last thing I remember, and since 1971, is I told the engineer Cosmo. I said, "Look, make me a copy of it, and let me go home and listen to that and see if I like it." That was it. So far as I was concerned, it was unfinished. So I completely forgot about it for decades, as the story goes. And it went through, as I was writing stuff for the Meters with the new record label, Warners, it didn't exist no more in my mind.
Right.
So, you know, and then after Katrina happened, everything with the C-Saint studio where it was stored, it was in under 10 feet of water. So I just felt like it didn't even exist. Even the copy I had didn't exist.
Wow.
So it went on for decades and decades and decades, man, and me not even thinking about this record. So then a guy got a call from a guy by the name Mike Nietzsche, I think. Mike Nietzsche, he's associated with the Beastie Boys, who has sampled some of the Meters.
Yeah.
He told me he had a tape from me. And he started rattling off the songs. And I said, "Whoa." I said, "You got that tape?" This was like 50-some years ago.
Yeah.
So what happened was the tape was in the storage compartment in Los Angeles for about maybe 20 years or more.
God bless.
Just sitting there. And the people who had the storage compartment lost it. And it got foreclosed on.
Mm. And
the tapes were bought by a flea market. The tapes were then put on a table at a swap meet. Because, you know, when you buy the contents of somebody's foreclosed storage space, you know, you buy everything that's in it. So the tapes were in that storage space. So the flea market bought it and they put it on this table at the swap meet. And there were several other tapes that was involved. It was about 10 meters, a quarter. And this was a quarter inch masters.
Right.
These was a quarter inch copy. It wasn't the 2-inch copy that you regularly have in the studio. These was a copy of the master. Since the master got destroyed in Katrina, this quarter inch tape became the master because that was the only thing that was left. So he told me he was going to send me the tape. So he sent it to me, and I was astounded by hearing it again, and didn't think that it was going to go any further. But little did I know that he had played it for this record label called Light in the Attic.
Right.
Light in the Attic fell in love with it, man, whatever it was. This quarter inch tape.
Did it feel like
they offered me a record deal, and I leased it to them. They gave me some money, and the record, the The tape came out with the record called Another Side. And it's called Another Side because it actually features another side of me.
Right.
You know, not the electric. I'm basically electric. I'm power rock funk guy. You
right.
know? And this was acoustic. It was like completely opposite from what I usually do. So I called it Another Side. And so the record came out on November 19th of this year. And right now they can't keep the records in the record stores for people wanting it. A 50-year-old record, which I consider is a perfect oxymoron. It's a brand new.
It's timeless.
50-year-old record, man. That's a hit. That's a hit record. And that's, you know, that's the story and the miraculous story behind
amazing.
What it is today.
Do you feel like you almost got a part of your soul back or something when they found that? Like you like almost had a microcosm of your earlier life as a musician, as a songwriter that could have been lost forever with the damage of Katrina and sort of the passage of time. Did you feel like you almost reclaimed some part of yourself when they found that?
Oh, no doubt. No doubt, man. You know, I think it goes further than that. It's a certain spirituality about what happened.
Yeah.
What happened with this record and to me, it's, you know, it's up for a Grammy, you know, in the historical sector, the historical category.
Right.
What's happened to me is not of this earth, man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm pinching myself. It's spiritual. It's I can't think about it, but a spiritual phenomenon, man.
Well, if you think about that first song, Thinking of the Day, there's something almost foreshadowing about it. You know, when you're thinking about tomorrow, tomorrow never comes. Thinking about tomorrow until my day is done. You know, it's almost like you are singing into the future back in 1972, hoping that this song, that this part of you will be heard, and it's never going to have the chance to be heard until now, you know, which is right. Kind of magic, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think everything you do in life, you know, it reflects the future. You don't know it. We don't know it.
Right.
We're doing it. But the future is the present, right now, as we speaking. This, what we're doing now, is going to reflect in the future. Sitting and waiting for the glorious day when I could hold you close and kiss you, pass the time away. Thinking of the moment when I could hold I could kiss you in the morning, squeeze you at night.
Well, you have my vote. I think it's about connecting the generations too, like that you have hip hop producers and collectors appreciating this and saving it and bringing it back, I think is what's so important. You know, I think when I hear a song like Riverfront, I can hear the groove that the Meters had mastered so well underneath it, but it's unmistakably your storytelling, right? And that's what's new in this record is that you're telling about these dock workers, about the New Orleans sort of working class, you know, stories that maybe get lost in some of the funk stuff that is more just about the groove. And
not to cut you off, but I got that idea, the Riverfront, from a guy by the name of Aaron Neville. Aaron, you know, we all grew up together, uptown. We all kind of grew up together, man. And Aaron, I remember Aaron working on the Riverfront. He used to carry bananas from the boats, you know, from the cargo. So when I thought about that song, I was thinking about Aaron. What he was doing. I mean, it wasn't as quite profound in all the little things that's written in the song. But when I thought about a guy working on a riverfront, I just extrapolated more than carrying bananas, which he did. And that's why I got the idea from him working on the riverfront. Aaron Neville working on the riverfront. Yeah, it seems so far. Working on a riverfront ain't easy, but it's gonna have to do.
It's gonna have to do. Yeah, it reminds me of my great-grandfather, who I never met. You know, he died in an accident as a longshoreman in New York City. And, you know, a lot of those stories never get told. You know, they sort of get lost.
A lot of people don't know the experience.
Yeah.
Of what goes down when you're working on a riverfront, you know?
During this last, crazy pandemic years, the supply chain breakdown in the port here in LA and Long Beach, like, you know, that really is how a lot of this country gets the things that they try to bring into their home. They buy online. Like, you can't buy anything without these dock workers actually getting it off the boats, getting it out of the shipping containers, getting them into trucks. You know, there's a whole system in place that if a couple people don't show up because they're sick or they're, you know, they can't do it, the whole system falls apart. You know, just kind
of
crazy.
One of the parts in the lyrics, because people don't know that what it went through before they wind up seeing it on the counter and going buying it at the store,
right?
And paying for it at the counter. It says because it all came here through cargo and trains and freight. All that stuff has to be loaded. And there's a lyric said, "Should I get my lunch at lunchtime?"
Right.
Thinking about where I've been. The whistle blows, there I go, back to work again. Then it says, the whistle blows in the evening, just about 6:30.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about that broken cargo hatch that I forgot to fix.
Good run.
I guess I'll fix it tomorrow, because tomorrow is another day. Still looking forward to Friday, because that's when I get my pay. That meant that they had to go into that cargo that was broken and fix it, because that's where all the food and everything came through that particular cargo hatch.
Right.
And you had to fix it. That wound up on everybody's food table.
Well, I think as, you know, working musicians, you know, a lot of folks do not appreciate musicians and songwriters as part of the working class in this country, part of the people that go to work and create something that everyone needs desperately. You know, that song Getting Nowhere, which has this really cool driving guitar beat. You know, you could see the frustration that you had as a songwriter, even back in the 70s, of not being able to be sort of appreciated or compensated. I know a lot of you guys get screwed out of royalties. It's so hard to know when you decide that I can't make this my life work anymore. You know, like, I have a young daughter now. She's 6-7 months old. You know, I tour with my band Dust Bowl Revival as much as I can, but it's this push and pull of like, when is it actually going to be enough? And it's never really enough right now. No, you know, you're getting nowhere. It feels like, even though you're loving it.
It's funny that you mentioned that song, because the three songs on that record that I've heard fans of mine and people in bands, they're playing it live on their gigs.
Yeah.
Already. And it's like really made, like, reaching high. It's all about, you know, it's all about you in the same business as this guy or this girl or this lady. And they seem to prosper. They seem to be prospering, but you're not. And because of some of the lyrics reflect, it said reaching high but not getting nowhere.
Right.
I must have gotten on the wrong cloud.
Uh-huh.
Watching people fly right on by me. I must have gotten lost in the crowd. That means that, hey, how could this person have a hit record and I don't? And I don't have it. So it has this frustration, but and like you said, it's something you have to love. I've been in it for 60 years. So if you don't love something and have a passion about it,
right,
there's no way you're gonna do this for all this time and not have that kind of strong passion.
Tell me what to do, or I'll melt away like ice. If I don't get no advice, could there be anyone to tell me where I went wrong? There's got to be a way, and I know I must be strong.
Well, it's like, again, is it a choice at a certain point? Like, I feel like it's beyond a choice for me, right? Like, the songs hit me, everything stops. I have to kind of put everything aside. But at a certain point you start to look around, you're like, well, is this a job, you know, or is it a passion, and can it be both? I don't know. You know, I think that's when, you know, you have to decide sometimes. And it's hard to decide, you know, you see people like, you know, you played with a lot of the Meters folks in Dr. John's hit record.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's a passion to me to look at it as work, and it might be the same in your case, to look at it as work and to make a decision to when does it stop?
Right.
Should I keep going, or when do I decide to stop? That's where the passion is the common denominator.
Yeah.
You have to look at it and say, well, when that passion hits you, that's never going to leave. That's when you know. You know, if the passion lessens, mm-hmm. then it's time to get out.
Yeah.
But if the passion is still strong, you're going to keep on going, regardless if you got 10 children.
Yeah.
Regardless of what, you're going to try your best to keep going. And some things happen in your life that the passion lessens. Right. Like me, like right now, I don't have the passion that I had years ago.
Yeah.
The passion has subsided. And I think it's because, not because of the music, or I'm not, you know, playing the music I want to play, but the more it's the deterioration of the business.
Yeah.
This is a brutal, brutal business. And when I'm on the air and I can't speak but the truth, this business of music is very brutal. And for anybody that's trying to think about getting into it, there's ways to defeat the brutality. And that's through education, of knowing what this business is about. It's not all about getting on the stage and playing and having fun and having everybody clapping. It's not all about that. Because the longer you do it, the brutality is still there. And it's a rough business, man. And I think I've lost passion for it because of that.
Right.
I do what I do, and I do it well. I haven't slacked up. I haven't lost anything. I guess that's through the God-given talent that I still have.
Right.
And at my age. But that doesn't dismiss what I have to deal with, the peripheral brutality that's in this stinky business.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, getting back to, you know, you playing on such, you know, legendary albums like Dr. John's Right Place, Wrong Time, you know, that is an album that...
What a-
sort of lifted a guy like Dr. John, which was, you know, he was a part of the New Orleans roots funk scene. You know, he could have just sort of been another guy playing his piano in a dark room, and all of a sudden that record is a pop hit, right? And
yeah.
It's still being played on classic rock radio to this day. You know, does it feel weird hearing that still be a, you know, a part of the culture, or, you know, is it gratifying to hear you playing on that?
Yeah, of course. When I hear it, I'm elated that it's playing, and I'm proud of it. You know, and I'm proud of what I did, you know, with it, and the success that it gave Dr. John and the Meters, actually. You know, with the right, Dr. John, the pieces all came together. For that record to become recognizable,
right.
And recognized, you know, all the pieces came together, man. Everything has to come together. It had the right people believing in Dr. John that he could do it. He happened to have the right songs that he wrote.
Yeah.
He happened to have the right producer, Alan Toussaint.
Yeah.
To produce it, and lastly, he had the right musicians, the Meters.
Yeah.
So when all of those things, you have all of those components, man, it can't help but come out great. It can't help but come out with sounding like something that people would want to hear. And I think that's what happened. All the pieces came together, man. Slipping, dodging, sneaking, peeping, hiding out there.
I mean, I think what is interesting about this Another Side record is that it shows, again, the connection between folk music, roots music, and the New Orleans funk soul sound, right? That they're not totally separate worlds, that they actually can be and should be connected more often. That's what I love most about Bill Withers, you know, first few records, is that, you know, he's playing an acoustic guitar, but he's got Booker T and the MGs as his backup band. It's like the perfect marriage of American music. It just like doesn't happen that often.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's a good description, a good comparison. You know, Bill Withers, he's one of those kind of guys, man. And when he, you know, I just so happened to knew him briefly, but more importantly, Terry, I knew the players that he used to record those songs.
Right.
So they were all a good friend of mine. And a guy by the name of Jam Gatson,
yep,
was on drum. I think Bill looked at James as somebody that he had to have join him in musically. Gatson is still living, you know, but Gatson, James Gatson, man, I want to mention his name, man. He's an unbelievable player, drums, and he contributed a lot to, and Gatson was basically a funk guy. And I think that's what gave Bill Withers rhythm and his lyrics, that funk, folk kind of feeling.
Right.
Sometimes it always only takes one person to do that, you know. And I think that's what happened with my record, you know, on the other side, you know, because I'm playing acoustic, but I got some great players on there. George Porter, bass player with the Meters. Zig playing on a couple of tracks. Alan Toussaint was the producer of the Meters. A guy by the name of James Black, which is a very prolific jazz and funk player. So even though it has this folk orientations, you cannot dismiss the unadulterated funk that's embodied in this record, you know. And I think that's what people, you know, got attracted to, you know. And I think that's what made it sound, rather than sound old, it sounded new. And you have to have that. So yeah, I mean, I think that's a good comparison. A funk folk record.
I mean, that's the music that I've been trying to make for my whole, you know, sort of life as a songwriter. And I feel like a lot of times folks are like, well, why don't you just have a folk band or a funk band? Like, why are you trying to do both? It makes no sense. But I think it does make perfect sense. I think Give Me Back My Lovin' is another song on there that, you know, James Black, the drummer, I think really highlights that. Just essential groove, man.
Yeah, that's him on Riverfront too, you know. That's James Black, man. And Give Me Back My Lovin', that's James. I know, and James was a very difficult guy to deal with. He had his demons, and he was a genius, man. He played everything. He played trumpet, he played piano, he played drums, and he played them all prolifically, man. But his head was screwed on backwards. And I just luckily ran into him. It was a magical thing, I guess, and got him to play on this stuff. I don't see how I did it. When I think back, I don't even remember how I approached him to even play on this stuff. But he played on it, man. And I think everybody on that record made the record what it is. Hurry, won't you give me back my loving? Hurry, won't you give me back my loving? Hurry, won't you give me back my loving? Won't you give me back my loving? Hurry. 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 Won't you give me back my loving?
Do you feel like at your advanced, beautiful age that playing live means something different than when you were a young man? Like, does it feel physically different, or is it just the same adrenaline hitting you when you get up there?
No doubt. I mean, as the years go by, you know, you play with more adrenaline. I feel it more now than when I was, you know, when I was younger. I feel like I have to, because I've learned so much, you know, over the years, you know, and I feel like I want to show people, fans, peers, how much I've learned. And every time I pick up the guitar, whether it's playing acoustic guitar or electric, I try to profess, look what I could do. You know, I could do this now. I could do more of this now because I'm older. I guess you might call it showing off, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, but in a good way, you know. I just want to show what I could do. And I think that it has for me now effect. That even though I've been around a long time, look what I still could do. I still could do this and I still could do that. So that's always a challenging to do.
When you see yourself you know, maybe looking down from another dimension, you know, you're not gonna be around forever. Let's just say 50 years from now, and you see young folks discovering your guitar work in the meters and even stuff that you played, you know, when you were a young man with the Supremes or, you know, Otis Redding. It's like, do you feel like there's a song or two that you wish could be sort of projected into the stars that you love more than almost any other song?
I don't know. I've played on so many things, man. I think I will always think about the song Sister Strut that I wrote, I think, for the Meters, and how it originated, how it happened, and, you know, what it has become, what people think about it, how many times it's been used in movies, opening for the World Series, sampled. Yeah. I think Sister Strut will always be the premier song in my life that I contribute to, you know, that I think about, that I did, you know, the way it happened. It wasn't planned, you know. We were playing at a club called the Ivanhoe on Bourbon Street, which was in the same configuration as the Meters, but we wasn't called the Meters then. We would open up our set with everybody opened up a set with called song called Holden. I forget the name of the group that did it, and I got tired of opening up our set with that. And so I introduced the melody that had been in my head for years. And I introduced it to George, Art, and Zig, the drummer. And we started opening up our sets with that song, with that melody. It wasn't even a name. And, you know, this guy comes in to play down to a prolific producer around town. Said, look, we want you guys to record these stuff that you were doing. So we went in the studio and recorded the song. And the song came out and sold about 250,000 copies within 2 weeks.
That'll work.
Yeah. So I think that song will always stick out in my mind, you know. Might not be one of my favorites, but it's
a classic.
It's definitely had this meaning.
You know, it's interesting when you hear your version of Elton John's classic Your Song on, you know, Another Side. It was recorded when it was still fresh. It had just sort of been unleashed onto the airwaves. Yep. And you can sort of feel the excitement of you singing it. Like, it wasn't a song that we almost take for granted as a classic. It was just brand new. How did you decide to include that onto these recordings?
I have no idea. I've always liked the song when it first came out. I would say that it had some special quality, the chord progression, and I didn't even understand what the lyrics was about. You know, I just liked the way this guy Elton John phrased it, and I wanted to do the same thing, you know, or come close to it. As a matter of fact, I got a note from Elton, from his manager. His manager, Elton, had sent a note about congratulating me and he thought really highly of what I did with his song. And I was blown away. He said, you know, please tell him that, you know, I really love what he did.
How wonderful life is while you're in the world.
And that really floored me when his management wrote the record label, the Attic, and Matt Sullivan is the name. And Matt sent me the text that what Elton John sent to his management. And the management actually knew Matt Sullivan and said, hey, listen, I want to send you this. You tell Leo this is what Elton said about what he did with his performance on Your Song. That blew me away.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Now that it's done, I hope you don't mind what I put down in words.
If there's someone that you could bring back from the dead, or that you could sort of astral project into the studio with you, who would you love to collaborate with?
Oh, wow, man, that's a hard question. That's a good one, but very, very difficult to answer. You know, I think this guy, I kind of patterned my songwriting and my learning process of structuring songs, how they should be structured, you know, with the intro and the verses and the bridges and stuff like that. I patterned it by learning, by playing with this guy in the studio so much, by the name of Alan Toussaint.
Yeah.
He always been a mentor of mine, and I learned so much from him. And little did I know, that as much as I felt about him, he felt the same way about me.
That's
this
beautiful.
Little old that he hired, to the point where he wrote a song called Leo. Until this very moment, I think about this. I'm saying, this guy, I mean, he could have wrote about anything and anybody.
Yeah.
Why did he decide to write a song about a guy that he hired as a musician? So I'm saying, he must have been really impressed by who I was and what I did. And the song is, he performed it live at the Jazz Fest, man. And if you look it up, on the YouTube, it's called, it's an interview I did. The song is called Leo.
Okay?
And you look it up, you might want to put it in this thing, man. And some of the lyrics is like, I'm saying, what? So when I heard the song, he said, man, I'm going to send you a demo of it. I couldn't understand it when he did it at the Jazz Fest. He said, I'm going to send you a demo. So he sent a demo up. I said, whoa. Well, he played all the parts. Took it upon himself to play all the keyboard parts, all the horn stabs on the keyboard, background vocals and everything, and lead vocals. And he sung it. And he did the demo where he could play it for the band of the performer at the Jazz Fest.
Nice.
And the song is, anybody seen Leo? Which way did he go? Left the funky trail. Taking music higher, setting grooves on fire. Funky groove that heard around the world. He walked the walk. He talked the talk. He lived and breathed music. Coming up with new things, with the New Orleans thing. Other players know him around the world. He's the meter man, the meter band. The whole world knows Leo. No telly.
Well, I think that your guitar playing, you know, has this essential quality to what makes, I would say, New Orleans music, but a lot of this sort of funk and rock and roll stuff from the 70s shine. You know, it's like a certain sound. When you think back on your guitar tone back then, you know, did you come up with a certain setting or a certain energy that you felt like this was my sound, or did it just sort of evolve?
I don't think anybody who gets the kind of recognition that I've gotten plans anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you start planning things, it fizzles out. But things happen now, and it doesn't have no meaning to it. But I think when things happen on a natural scale,
right?
It just, you know, I'm just Leo. I'm not this person. I'm just Leo. Then it becomes unique. And I think the uniqueness brings out the special part of what that is. Like you said, the sound is just unplanned. It's, you know, it's something you try to dial up, and you like that song, that sound.
Mm-hmm.
You dial it, amplifier, and you stick with it. And if you believe in that sound, that you feel good about it, then it manifests itself into who you are, and it becomes you.
Mm.
And I don't think you could plan nothing like that. Well, I'm gonna buy a Fender guitar. I'm gonna buy a Strat. And I'm gonna buy a Fender amp, and I'm gonna have this sound.
Uh-huh.
You can't plan that.
What were you playing on Hey Pocky Away? Like, what was that guitar and amp? Do you remember?
That was, man, that all of that stuff, all of the five albums we did was recorded with a guitar called a Starcaster.
Mm-hmm.
That Starcaster is on the wall of the Hard Rock Cafe in New Orleans.
Mm.
That nobody else played one. Nobody, I was the only one that played the Starcaster with any kind of recognition.
How did you get that guitar? Like, what was the story behind getting it?
Another unplanned thing is a store called Worldlines. That's not there no more. It's now the Palace Cafe. It's on Canal Street. I saw this guitar on the wall, and it was black. I said, whoa. And that's why I asked the guy. I said, man, how much is this guitar here? And it was a semi-hollow body guitar.
Mm-hmm.
I said, how much is this guitar? And the guy said $750, believe it or not, back then. Mm. And it's, you know, it's like $5,000-$6,000 now.
Right.
But well, they don't make them anymore, number one. So I bought it. And I just fell in love with it, man. And that's all I've ever, that's all I used.
Mm.
You know, until you know, until I started, you know, I was living in Los Angeles, and I had it playing it up there too. And I got into some really money problems. I was broke, and I needed the whole history behind it. I needed money really bad, you know, just to keep a roof over my head.
Right.
There's a store called Norm's Rare Guitars.
Mm-hmm.
In Los Angeles, you might know of it.
Yeah.
You know, so Norm was a good friend of mine, and he knew what I did with the meters and stuff, so he respected me. So I used to go up in there to get, you know, stuff, and so I needed money really bad. So Norm said, listen, man, say, you ever want to sell a guitar, let me know. I said, okay. So I went there with the guitar because I needed money. Mm. I sold that Stellcaster to Norm for $4,000. Mm. Yeah, how much was it? I think it was about $4,000, that was a lot of money back then. You know,
yeah,
this was a lot of money back then, man. $4,000. I thought I was like, whoa, I was rich. But what I didn't know was, they was aware of, the artifact that you see on the wall of the Hard Rock and stuff like that. Everybody thinks those things were given
right.
to the Hard Rock, but you know, the Hard Rock bought them from these different artists, and they, you know, the artists, they paid money for it. So I sold my Stellcaster to Norm, and then Norm, who was educated up to that, got in contact with the Hard Rock Cafe and sold it to them for three times as much.
You ever want to get it back?
Do I want to get it back?
Yeah.
They'll never give it back to me. They'll never get it. I'll never get it back. I'm satisfied. You know, I'm good. I'm good with that. I'm good with that, man. It's serving its purpose.
I never understood why, you know, guitar players, if you love a guitar that you write on, that you perform with, why would you want a bunch of guitars, right? I have this Martin Cherrywood acoustic that I've been pretty much playing live with exclusively for the last 10 years, but it's getting pretty beat up. You know, it's got a hole in it. It's my road dog, but I knew that I needed to start maybe looking for something that could be a little more durable, that could have a little more of an electric and acoustic sound together. And I saw this archtop made by this luthier, Eric Schulte. It's like a handmade guitar. I live down the street from McCabe's Guitar Shop, which is an awesome place here in Santa Monica in LA. And I have to fall in love with a guitar. It's like a romance, you know? And I only bought a couple guitars my whole life. I have this 1950 Gibson archtop that I play mostly at home and write on, but I don't really want to bring it out. And so this one, I just finally bought. I kept going in there over and over again. And they were like, bro, you got to make a decision. I think it's calling to you, you know, and I felt it. I felt the guitar calling to me in a weird sort of spiritual way. And I brought my little daughter in there and I played the guitar for her. And she was like smiling her ass off the whole time. And I was like, all right, I got to bring this baby home. The baby and the guitar.
I have about, 30 some guitars.
Yeah.
As I'm looking at, I got them all lined up on stands, and I look at them every day.
Yeah.
I only use a couple of them.
Yeah.
But just to have them, it's like my baby, they become your babies.
Yeah.
They actually become your babies, man.
Well, I think what's interesting is that your guitar playing has been sort of threading throughout a lot of American music that people may not even realize, right? So you can't really imagine someone playing, you know, with Etta James, but also touring with Jimmy Buffett, right? That's like, how could that be possible?
Yeah. And then go do a tour, a 6-month tour with Robert Palmer. You know,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a pretty, I've had a very unique career, man, to be able to adjust to whatever is put in front of me, you know, and I think that's the way I came up. I came up having to learn how to play different genres of music.
Right.
Just to survive. You know, I do 3 or 4 gigs in one day. I go do a Dixieland gig and I do another R&B gig after that, and I go do a jazz gig after that. So you have to learn how to do that and have the talent. Yeah, you have to have the ability to do that, but you had to be able to do that to survive,
right?
In New Orleans, you know, because the gigs wouldn't, you know, the gigs wouldn't play back then. The gigs wouldn't pay, but like you get a gig that pay you $20,
right?
For all night, paying you 20, that was a lot of money, man.
Yeah.
So you do about 2 or 3 of them gigs a day in a 24-hour period, you got what, $60. That paid the rent, yeah, and more, you know, and nowhere near that today. You know, you in an apartment, don't talk about you. They used to call it cents. Hey, man, I got a 10 cent gig.
Yeah.
I played gigs coming up for $10.
Right.
But it still was money. It still was, that was a lot of money then.
Right.
You know, when gas costs you 30 cents a gallon.
Yep.
You know, so I say, how much the gig paying, man? They say, oh, 30 cents. I said, a 30 cent gig? What? That was like making $1,000 today.
Let's take us out with the really beautiful love song you have on here, You've Become a Habit. I think folks, you know, who don't know your work really should, because I think you are a backbone of what American music really is. And again, I think the combination of soul music, folk music, roots, funk, rock and roll, that's what makes, I think, our music in this country so timeless and so needed everywhere, right? It's the soul that's in all of it. And what you created in Another Side, I think, is my favorite thing, which is bringing the storytelling of folk music with this groovy funk backbeat. And I love what that this is finally into the world now. You know, it's needed.
But, to comment on before we leave, comment on You Become a Habit, you know, quite frankly, I got that idea. There's a movie, just where the public would know. Uh-huh. There's a movie called Irma LaDuke, and it came out years ago. It starred Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine.
Yep.
And when the movie came out, I fell in love with that music, that movie as a kid. And Shirley MacLaine was a lady of the street. But they couldn't profess that in the movie, because it was, you know, everybody, it was an all-age movie. And Jack Lemmon was a train conductor.
Mm.
And they wound up befriending each other, and they wound up being together all the time. And he just, like, couldn't help but be around her. But it wasn't in a sexual way, because he couldn't show that on a TV, on a movie. But I did. I took it another step further.
Mm.
You know, Shirley MacLaine was a prostitute.
Right.
She was a lady of the night. And this guy, who was John Lemon, was a guy that just, he had relationships with her, and he fell in love with, and her name was Fancy. He fell in love with Fancy. He fell in love with her. Mm. And she became a habit. Him buying, you know, her selling it to him and stuff like that.
Yeah.
She became a habit to him. And because he said Fancy was a real mistreater. All the folks would gather to see her. She loved every night. Men would fuss and fight. Turn you on in a flash and turn you off just as fast. Oh, Fancy, you become a habit to me. Yeah, I was lonely one afternoon. I thought I'd take a walk with the moon. She stepped out the dark, that's when she took my heart. She turned me on from night until dawn. Oh, Fancy, you become a habit to me.
Well, I think the world needs this music right now, and I'm glad that you're getting out there.
There we go.
All right.
Thank you.
All right, man. We'll keep up the good work.
Thanks again.
All right, man. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Fancy, you become a habit to me.
There he goes, Leo Nocentelli, everybody. You can go to leonocentelli.com for his newest record. It's called Another Side. Yes, 50 years in the making, released by Light in the Attic Records. What a cool treasure to have for your collection. And there's a really cool colored vinyl you can get, too. If you know me at all, you know that I love the music of New Orleans so much. And our music festival, the Paramount Ranch Sonic Boom, which Dust Bowl Revival is hosting October 15th in L.A., will feature Grammy winners Rebirth Brass Band, direct from NOLA. As always, the show on the road is written, produced, and edited by yours truly, Zach Lupitin, and we are a part of the BGS Podcast Network. Stay safe, buy a festival ticket if you can, and we'll see you on the trail.
Well, fancy.
Hey, you. Did you have any plans this year? Ha! How's that going? Did you get 2020? Well, welcome to a brand new podcast called 2020, where myself, Benny Goodman, and my good friends Corey Pazin and Siobhan Cronin from the band Lost Symphony also got 2020.
And since the world ended this year, we decided why not just check in with some of our friends in the music industry and see how everyone's doing.
We're going to get a candid look at life on and off the stage, as well as the mindset of some of the most successful people in the entertainment industry.
New episodes drop every Sunday and Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern.
And you can listen at 2020-d.com, soundtalentmedia.com, or on your favorite podcast app.